Welcome to Aromatic Chat, the podcast that introduces you to registered, clinical, and certified aromatherapists around the world. Every other week, my baby girl sits down with a different aromatherapist to learn about their aromatic journey and how they use aromatherapy in their lives and their business. Aromatic Chat is produced by Lemon Balm Coaching, and my daughter Melissa is your host. She is a master transformational coach and a registered aromatherapist.
Hey friends, welcome to episode number 70, Aromatic Chat with J.K. DeLapp of the Rising Phoenix Perfumery. I had the honor of being a speaker at the Aroma Summit last year alongside J.K. and found his perfumery business so intriguing. I know of other aromatherapists who use essential oils to create natural perfumes, but JK takes it to a whole nother level, and I cannot wait for you to hear his amazing journey. So let's get started. JK, I am so glad that you're here on Aromatic Chat. We were back in May of last year. We were in the Aroma Summit together and through Aroma Trust. That's what it is. Aroma Trust, yes. With Emily Carpenter. And I was just really intrigued with what you're doing with these natural products that aromatherapists are all about. And I just was so excited when you agreed to come on to Aromatic Chat and share your journey. So thank you so much for being here.
Awesome to be here. Thank you so much for having me on board.
Absolutely.
And it's great to see you again.
Oh, it's great to see you too. And I love your workshop. I hope people will hop on YouTube so they can see a little bit of where you work, because it's different than most aromatherapists, apothecaries, but you do work with the same type of materials that aromatherapists use. So I hope people will hop over to YouTube, check it out. But if not, that's okay. We'll still get to hear your story. So the very first thing I always love to start with is the aromatic journey, because I just really feel like our stories matter so much, especially in this day and age with social media and not really connecting with people. I think our stories connect us. So tell us how in the world you ended up, and I'm really intrigued. I want to know this information. How in the world did you end up in natural perfumery?
I really pegged my story starting to about when I was 11 years old. I was the oldest of three kids, and my dad for about a decade worked out of town. So he was home on weekends and gone during the week. And even then, when you're in and out of town like that, sometimes you're not always fully there.
Right.
And so as the oldest kid at 11, you know, my dad, I mean, my family, we were always helping each other out anyway, but my dad really really impressed upon me to help. And the first thing that I started doing was helping my mom cook in the kitchen. And so really my entire aromatic journey, all of my work in medicine, everything that I've been doing, I really tie back to food and the kitchen, and that's where I started to learn everything. And so as I had started learning how to cook and pretty much mastered everything that my mom was making, I got bored making the same, you know, 10, 15, 20 things, whatever it is that we were making. And so it really makes me sound like an old man when I'm like, and this was before the internet. So I actually had to read books.
Right.
You know, which meant that I had to go to a library, because there was nothing like the internet really was not, you couldn't hop on 30 years ago and look up a recipe.
Right.
Were there those kinds of things out there? Maybe, but not in any kind of capacity that I was able to search. And so I started getting cookbooks from all over the place. And this was my first real exposure to, I mean, we had always been a really kind of multicultural family, just with the nature of the work my parents did, the neighborhoods that I grew up in, and also my own curiosity and friendships. And I mean, I was always the minority growing up. So as I started looking at cookbooks and learning about food, inevitably you bump into, what the heck is that ingredient? How do I get these things? What was this used for? Why were people eating this? And so my curiosity in herbs really started again from a culinary perspective. And we've got tons and tons of, there's like a massive international community here. And so I started hitting up international grocery stores, trying to find where to find things. Again, this is still kind of pre-internet, so it's not like I could order things and have them shipped to me. I was also eating at restaurants, trying things. And so I learned at 16 that if I started feeling sick, I would just go eat Thai food, and I would eat really spicy Thai food, and somehow I stopped getting sick. I remember my girlfriend at the time, way back when, Sarah, if you ever happen to watch this, you know, she would have stuff that would go on, and I'd be like, all right, we're going out for Thai tonight. And then she just wouldn't get sick. And then her mom was like, why aren't you getting sick anymore? And so I started learning that food was medicine. So fast forward, like in college, I worked in a kitchen. I kind of accidentally started a catering company, and I'd cater up to groups of almost 500, which was really bizarre. Had no idea what I was doing. And yet I was like being put in charge of like massive, you know, events when I was in college. Like I said, I worked in a kitchen. So that also started giving me some, not like a formal education in cooking, but I really had to learn really fast, you know, really what I was doing. And my last year in college, I studied abroad. I was in Southern France in Avignon. I worked in Paris with the University of Georgia afterwards for a little bit. I moved back to Georgia. I worked in film and television. Like I'm all over the place. This is why I said this is the real abbreviated version. Mm-hmm. So fast forward at 27 years old, I ended up going to school for Chinese medicine. There's a whole story to that too, but we'll save you on that this time around for the next chat.
Okay.
And I moved out to San Diego and started studying out there. And it was about halfway through the education that I was like, wait a minute. Pharmaceuticals, nutraceuticals, cosmetics, flavor, fragrance, the spice trade, like all of these big, you know, international global businesses were built on the back of herbs. And everything is made using essentially the pharmacy compounding education that I was getting while I was in school. So that was the first thing that clicked. And as that idea started going around, I started realizing like, oh, I could be a physician, or I could be a physician and. Mm. And I wanted to explore the and. You know, all right, I could be a doctor, or I could do a whole bunch of other stuff with this. What else can I do? And I grew up using incense. You know, think again, 20, 30 years ago, how limited the availability of things was. And when I started realizing that we had to have had, I don't know, 600 ingredients in the pharmacy there at the school. And I was like, oh, this is all the stuff that incense is made from. So I started burning things and mixing stuff. And the two big things that I wanted that I couldn't really find adequate quality of was sandalwood and agarwood.
Right.
And most people here in the West are familiar with sandalwood. A lot of people aren't familiar with agarwood, which comes from all over Southeast Asia. And really the backbone of both the fragrance and the incense industries are built on the backs of sandalwood and agarwood. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I set out to try and find was good quality sandalwood and agarwood. And I was really disappointed. So at this point, there's an internet, and I was able to start kind of looking around, and I was able to kind of roundabout ways connect with some materials, but that still was, I was trying to find better and better quality stuff. The other thing too, is it dawned on me, oh, essential oils are essentially pharmaceutical grade extracts of herbs.
Right.
So if that's the case, sandalwood is sandalwood oil and agarwood is oud oil. Okay. Well, I know what those are. How do I make sandalwood and agarwood oil? And I had no idea what I was doing with distilling. And the first thing that I started doing after I was connecting with the wood was I had connected with some distillers and then started commissioning distillations of materials. And that eventually grew to, I would buy equipment. It sounds more impressive than it really is, but now I have several distillation operations in Southeast Asia where we produce a lot of the key materials that I use in products. I have a few employees where we both create raw materials, and then we also source and procure raw materials. So I have, you know, boots on the ground in a couple different places. I have a vast network of people that I work with. You know, it's a lot of fun for me because I've always been I don't know. I've always been very internationally minded. You live abroad. You can understand what I'm saying here. There's just a different kind of mentality to it. And it's really funny for a lot of these guys because they've never, like, Americans are not involved in these trades, especially like a white kid from, you know, Georgia. And they're tickled to death out of this American guy. And it's even funnier because I've built a name for myself over the years. And so I'm not just the first American a lot of these guys have worked with, but I have a legitimate, well-respected company that a lot of people are very proud to be working with, working for, affiliated with, sourcing for. And so, you know, like any company, as you start growing in size, you know, I have a lot of people that reach out always trying to sell me stuff. I probably get a couple hundred messages a day from people, but I try to direct folks again to the people that I work with. And so it's a way of also building up the people that I work with, because the way that I was raised is, you know, first off, what does it cost to be nice? There's the a rising tide raises all boats. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a lot of these kinds of mentalities I already grew up with. And so I try to empower the people that I work with to grow and to take a little bit of control and ownership of what we're doing. And so what started in the kitchen ultimately led me to med school. I've lived and worked in France. I was in Shanghai for a little bit, working out of three hospitals, spent some time working in a hospital in San Diego, moved back to Metro Atlanta in 2014. You know, for anybody who's watching, I've got a new perfumery course that we've been filming recently. And part of what I'll say to you, what I was saying to these folks, I started on the top of a dresser in my bedroom in the middle, you know, in med school, and the table that we were filming this thing on, I was like, this table that I'm filming this on for you is bigger than my original workspace. And then that grew eventually when I moved back home to Atlanta. I had to move in with my parents for a little bit while I was getting my feet under me. And so I graduated to a pool table. And I felt like, man, I've got this massive desk. And we put a ping pong table on top. So I was working on a ping pong table. And then I 6 or 7 years ago, I moved into the space that I'm in. Now I've got 2 or 3 offices that I work out of. And things continue to grow. In many ways, I'm still a one-man show because it's me doing all the work over here. I have my Rising Phoenix team that is helping me produce, procure, and otherwise get the key materials that go into products as well as raw materials that I sell. I try to work with artisan distillers, you know, every chance that I can. I try not to source, you know, through the big boys, but that does happen sometimes too, because they're the only resource for these materials.
Right.
But I do try to work with folks on the ground. We try to create much better versions of what's generally out there. Right. You know, so one of the things that I will hear often as people buy my products is that they'll look at some of the products and say, you know, these are expensive. I can get less expensive stuff. And it's like, well, yeah, I'm eating a $20 hamburger and you can get a $2 hamburger out there. Probably not the same thing.
Right.
Call them hamburgers, but the hamburger you're eating might not even really be hamburger.
Right. It's the same thing with tattoos. A cheap tattoo isn't good and a good tattoo isn't cheap.
Right.
So exactly. It's the same thing.
And you can generally tell the difference between them when you see them.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And just as perfumers and aromatherapists, like, we can smell something and go, that's not that great. But this one I like. Yeah.
Right.
Same thing.
Yeah. And I think everybody has an innate ability to, in some ways, sense the nuance and the quality differences between things.
Right.
You can eat two foods and be like, this is better than this. You can smell things. And when people get their hands on things, there's a perfumer over in France that I just got some material for. And he was funny because I told him up front, I was like, you know, you could probably find less expensive materials, especially with the resources at your disposal. But I promise you, you are not going to find better quality, let alone even though my prices look high, you're not going to find better quality at my price points. This guy looked at everything and he was like, you're right. You know, your prices are a little bit higher than what I normally find. And then he gets the material that I sent to him and he was like, okay, Now I think your material is cheap.
Right.
He's like, your material is inexpensive because the quality is so much better than what he could get his hands on for these materials that I was getting.
Right.
And I hear this from a lot of people. I have customers in 55 countries, and you know, people will bitch and moan because they have their own resources. They can get things for less expensive.
Right.
I mean, I'm never going to be able to sell you a coconut for less than you can buy in Thailand.
Right. Like, I can pick them up on the side of the road in Guam.
So. Exactly. Like, I'm not going to be able to source these things for less. I'm an American company. Obviously, there's an expense to these things.
Right.
But it's not just about price. The quality is so much different and so much better and so much more complex. There's so much more character.
Aromatherapists
usually look for key peaks to say that, oh, this has, you know, X, Y, and Z functionality. Whereas a perfumer, because we're usually looking both for scent quality, you know, how pleasing something smells, and then also the longevity of something. I would argue, as you look for a broader chemical profile, that adds complexity. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the importance of peaks, because those are the things that give it, you know, its characteristic scent or its characteristic function.
Right. So I'm very curious, are you still practicing Chinese medicine first?
Yep. I had patients earlier today. It's been a very patient heavy week as I'm trying to get orders out.
The other thing I'm very curious about is the perfumery part of what you do. Is this self-taught? Did you go to school for perfumer? How did you become a perfumer?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I went to medical school and I applied some of the pharmacy compounding knowledge, which is mm-hmm. more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, I have a formal education.
Okay.
As it comes to putting fragrance together, that I would say is self-taught.
Self-taught. So when people come to Rising Phoenix, they're really getting JK formulations. It's not like you went to school, learned that this goes with this, this goes with this, this goes with this. It's all you.
It's all me.
Have you always been a super creative person?
Yes and no. And that is why perfumery is such a great outlet for me. When I was young, I really wished I could, you know, wail on a guitar. I bought a guitar. I'm terrible. I really wished that I was very artistic and I could, you know, paint or draw. I even went so far as to take classes in France when I was in school in France. Now, maybe there was a little bit of a bias because I could never get better than a C in my class. I went so far as to test a theory that I bought a picture and then I sketched it out and I still got a C on it.
Mm.
So was I really that bad at drawing? I don't know. But I was terrible. I have no natural artistic talent in that regard. Maybe you could argue in the kitchen I have artistic talent. I am a good cook.
Okay, so I have struggled with this exact same thing, right? I never considered myself creative because of the same reason. I wasn't musical. I couldn't draw. But creativity isn't just those things. That's art. That's a musical ability or an artistic ability. Creativity is something totally different. And I would argue that you are extremely creative to be able to take these natural products and create scents that people love.
Well, and to try and reverse engineer them, like how did somebody make this and how do I go about making products like this? I've had to do this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's
very creative.
We have events here that we call Oud Fests. And so a few years back at one of the Oud Fests, we had a whole bunch of people. And one of the guys that flew in from California was a big art aficionado.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember sitting and we're talking. I broke this guy's heart because he was like, "You're such a great artist." He's going on and on about this. And I was like, I don't know if I see my... Like, I don't picture myself as an artist. I don't think of myself as an artist. And I mentioned this not because I broke his heart, but that conversation kind of sparked in me the question of, well, am I making art? Because I have to design products. There's a creative process. I never really thought of it as being artistic. Mm-hmm. But the finished product might be a piece of art.
how can people find you? I mean, you've already mentioned the name of your company a couple of times, but if they were interested in checking out what you have to offer, how could they find you?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hey friends, if you're an aromatherapist, here's something really important that you may not have been taught in aromatherapy school. Connecting with other professional aromatherapists is really important to the health of your practice. Why? Because our brains are designed for connection. Connection, team, clan, tribe, core group, no matter what you call it, it's about survival. When you are isolated, it's easy to become discouraged and feel like nothing you're doing really matters. But when you're connected and part of a larger group focused on the same goal, you're energized, and maybe you even feel invincible. Well, coming up September 26th through 28th, you have a chance to be a part of a community of aromatherapists at the Aromatics in Action International Conference, Embracing and Composing Sustainable Aromatics in Nashville, Tennessee, USA, brought to you by the Alliance of International Aromatherapists. The AIA is bringing together industry leaders and educators, as well as exhibitors, at their first post-pandemic in-person conference. There will also be on-demand sessions to add more learning opportunities and continuing education. I invite you to visit alliance-aromatherapist.org and sign up today. That's alliance-aromatherapist.org, or visit the link in the show notes and sign up today to join the AIA and be a part of the tribe.
So a few things. The first I would say is that a general search of J.K. Dalap Rising Phoenix will probably get you 30 pages. There's a lot of content on the internet about working things in several languages. If you're looking for me specifically at this time, I still operate off of Etsy. And so if you look up Rising Phoenix Perfume, my shop will pop up in Etsy. If you look up the Rising Phoenix Perfumery in Instagram, we'll pop up there. I have a Fans of Rising Phoenix Perfumery page on Facebook.
So tell me, how does it work? Like, is it just like walking into a retail store and there's a bunch of scents to choose from, or do you create custom scents?
For the most part, everything is online. I've got the Etsy shop that I operate out of, and then there are an awful lot of people. There's a number of different channels that people have to get in touch with me. And so if it's not on Etsy, I'm usually sending somebody a PayPal invoice. And then I ship out from there. There's a lot of, quote, like finished product that's in the shop. But then there's a lot of things that I have to cut, weigh out, measure. It's very hands-on. It's a little, I need help, but it's not a job that you can be here like for a couple hours a week and get a hang of it. And so I have a lot of demand, a lot of requests to be going into distribution. The challenge there is that people usually want sprays, spray perfumes. I generally make attars and incense and a wide variety of products. And so most of these places want to start with the sprays because that's what their customers are familiar with, and then expand into other things. It's very capital intensive, and the work I do already is very capital intensive. And so this is usually the challenge, is that all of my existing revenue and capital gets folded back into the existing operation. I just had somebody walk in here the other day and they're like, I have money. What can we do with it? I was like, okay, so let's talk.
Wow. Well, that's kind of cool.
Well, it's happened a number of times. Getting all the things to fire at the right time. That's the challenge.
Yeah, that's the challenge. I do remember back at the Aroma Summit, you shared some of the cost of the products, the raw products that you purchase. Can you just give us just a general idea, lowest to highest, just so the people know, like, this is not a hobby for you. It's not a hobby.
No. Before I answer that question, I'll give a little funny story. When I first got started, spending $100 was big money. It then progressed to spending $1,000 as big money. And then you get to like, oh, $2,500 or $5,000 or $10,000 is big money. Mm-hmm. And then it just keeps getting bigger. And you turn around and you spend $100 like it was a dollar. Mm-hmm. And so this happens a lot. You know, sometimes we'll go out and grab a meal and it'll cost $100. My wife will be like, and I'm like, this is the cheapest thing I've done all month.
Right. But isn't that true? Isn't it interesting with every stage of business growth, there's new money beliefs that have to be conquered and overcome and dealt with and faced and everything. Yeah.
It's a challenge. It's hard to wrap your head around, you know, as the revenue grows and the business grows and the revenue grows and the business grows,
right?
Growing businesses is expensive, and mm-hmm. businesses are very hungry beasts, and their food is money. You really have to watch sometimes how and where you spend money. But on the same token, I think it's a blessing to not sweat every time I pull the trigger on something. And you're asking about things. I mean, I could pull out a 100-milliliter bottle of something and it could easily be 5, 6, 10K.
Wow.
Okay. I've got there's a liter bottle of something that I like pulling out for folks. I have a liter of this oil that was distilled in 1949.
Mm.
And I'll ask people as I put it into their hands, have you ever held a house?
Oh my word. Wow.
And people are like, and I was like, yeah, the market value of the product is about $880,000 that's in the bottle.
Oh my word.
Yeah. So I tell people, I'm like, have you ever held a house? And they hold it and the look on their face is panic, because what happens if I drop this?
Wow. And for that particular product, do you have a specific perfume that you make with it?
So I actually sell that oil as a straight oil. This is an oud oil. Is an oil that's from 1949.
Wow.
And it is from, I think that's the Imphal Atik. So it's from Imphal in India. It's not on the border, but it's nearing the border of Burma, so modern day Myanmar. And you know, it was distilled more than 70 years ago. It's not the oldest oil that I have on hand, but in the oud world, as the oils gain in age, I mean, it's a finite resource. There's only so right. much of it.
Right.
You know, I've got the batch, and it is something that people approach with a little bit of awe and reverence, mm-hmm. And then a little bit of sticker shock.
So if someone wanted to get some of that oud oil,
largely the bottles go by an old Arabic measurement called a tola.
Okay.
Which is just shy of 12 milliliters. It's like 11.667 milliliters.
Okay.
A lot of aromatherapists tend to measure by volume.
Right.
Perfumers measure by weight. You'll usually get a little bit more oil when measuring by weight.
Okay. So what would be the smallest weight of this oil that you would sell raw?
In small quantities, it's easier to think of volume and weight being roughly 1 to 1.
Okay.
It starts to make a bigger difference as the quantities get larger, but in small quantities, it's roughly 1 to 1. So you can think of that kind of as like a 0.3 milliliter, 1 milliliter, and 3 milliliter size.
Okay.
And then you have a tola size, which is, you know, roughly 12 milliliters or 12 grams.
And what would that cost if someone wanted to purchase that from you? I'm just curious.
I knew you were going to ask, and I'm looking it up right now. 0.3 gram is $100.
That's not as bad as I thought it was going to be honest. So,
well, I'll charge you a little extra when you, so I take it back. It's the I offer a 0.1 gram size in this. That's 100.
Okay.
0.3 gram is 285.
Okay.
If I stand a little corrected.
So I just wanted people to kind of have an idea of the quality of the products that you're using to make your perfumes. So why would someone choose a natural perfume over going into the store and just buying something off the shelf?
Well, that's a question that I think a lot of folks here will probably already understand, if not know. And that is, many of us are trying to cut out the crap.
Right.
Whether it's in food, whether it's in our cosmetics and household products. You know, synthetics in any one place is probably not going to knock us off. But when it's everything being synthetic, that tends to weigh folks down. And I can Right. tell you from, you know, my work in clinic, people come in with problems and I'll joke with people, you know, I don't want you to come in here and feel like everything in your life needs to change. But everything in your life needs to change. Even with the most motivated people coming in, it can be very challenging to tackle everything all at once.
Right.
And so we try to approach things taking bites you know, here and there. Nobody eats a meal in one bite. I tell people you usually have to take smaller bites, chew it and swallow. Mm-hmm. One of the easiest places that they can usually make improvements is with their fragrance products, because there are readily available products that you can buy that have a lower chemical load and are easier on the body. Whether you're cleaning your toilet or your dishes or your laundry, there are better versions of things out there. Mm-hmm. When it comes to fragrance, I would say that the vast majority of people in the fragrance realm, I would liken to McDonald's, where 80% of the hamburgers people are eating are essentially fake hamburgers.
Right.
And the vast majority of the market is buying synthetic products. They're buying fake stuff. And when I say fake, I'm not talking about a knockoff. I'm talking about artificial or synthetic. You know, as a practice, I have both my philosophical and my practical way of looking at things. Philosophically, obviously, I like to try and cut out synthetics. In real life, I also design products for other companies, and sometimes you need to use synthetics. And so I try to take my knowledge and make better versions of products for people. My own line of products is a natural line of products, 100% natural. But I have other products that I will at some point launch in the future that kind of bridge that gap. But again, you do it better and much cleaner than what's being done commercially. And so, mm-hmm. At some point, I have several lines that I'll be releasing. I've got essentially three different tiers where I have 100% natural. I have what I call naturally minded, which are, I would say, largely natural. And then I have more of a commercial focused, mm-hmm. where it is still, if commercial products you're lucky to find in the maybe 1 or 2 or 3% natural, my commercial products would still probably be between 45% and 60% natural.
Beautiful. I love that idea of having the tiers. That's great.
Well, the thing is that you have to meet people where they are. And right. if you have any hope of getting them over to the 100% naturals, you have to hook them somewhere. And you do that with better quality commercial, a better quality commercial quality product. And then they start, that's how you pique their curiosity about other products. Mm-hmm. And so I get a lot of people who are trying naturals for the first time, and they come to me, and I try to tell them up front. They don't really understand what I'm saying. Usually, look, this isn't going to smell like the fragrance you're used to. This isn't going to perform the same way.
Right.
It's not going to, I ask people what they smell, what they like to smell, what they like to wear, and the products that they give me. I'm like, yeah, nothing I make is going to smell like that. And sometimes they get it. And other times, they want to, they don't understand why the hamburger you're giving them doesn't taste like McDonald's. Mm-hmm. And, not to be picking on McDonald's. Sorry, McDonald's.
No, I get it.
I'm just using you as an analogy.
Yes.
I think as I make products, I try to make not only the best quality and the most natural products. We try to create a lot of the key materials that we use. And so we have, the most famous fragrance reviewer in the world categorized me as a steampunk perfumer. And I was like, yeah, that's not how I think of what I'm doing at all, but okay. So it just gives you an idea of what somebody who is entrenched in the commercial commodity industry sees in an operation like mine. But to me, that's like, if all you're used to eating is chain restaurant food, and then you go to a standalone, real food restaurant, you look at it like it's some kind of an anomaly.
And then you taste it and you go, okay, I get it.
Right. How do I get more of this? And why doesn't all food taste like this?
Right. Right. Oh my gosh. Okay. So I'm curious, what are some of your other passions? Because you seem like a pretty well-rounded guy.
I think everything, like I said, for me is rooted in the kitchen. There's a few caveats to this. We have a magnet that I've had on my fridge for years that says, love people, feed them tasty food.
Nice.
And ever since I was a kid, like I said, I grew up in a real multicultural setting. I think the best way to get to know a culture and a people is through their food.
Yes.
And I've always said that it's really hard to hate somebody who's feeding you tasty food. My wife and I, we tend to joke that we vacation mouth first. Once we've decided on what it's going to do, like, okay, we want to go to this part of the country because we want to go to a national park. All right, good. The very next thing that we look up at is, what the heck can we eat out there? And if we can't find anything good to eat, we might end up picking a different place to go. It usually comes down to like food and food culture and right. Is there interesting things there? And, you know, can we get a taste of the local culture? So for me, a lot of our recreation, I would say, kind of revolves around food, whether that's going out to eat with friends, having people over. When I was in med school, I was kind of like our social chair, and I would cook for 20, 30, 40, 50 people at a time and have people over at the house. We'd essentially throw parties at the house that started with food and ended with dancing.
Well, yeah. And you were the accidental caterer. I mean,
right. Well, that definitely. Was when I was in college. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I first met my wife, in med school, we happened to live in the same town, and she thought I was like some raging party animal. And I was like, no, I'm really not like that. There's no alcohol. There's no drugs. I'm not sleeping around. I'm pretty boring in that regard. It was more about bringing people together and creating right. a little bit of community. I feel like the term safe spaces has been kind of taken over and abused a little bit, but you know, it was creating a space where people could come together. It didn't matter who you were
and just be yourself and enjoy.
Right. And we had a good time. It was always safe. Nobody had to worry about being drugged or raped or, you know, right. beat up or right. shot or, you know, it's like, there was none of that. We always right. created really cool atmospheres, cool parties. People come to my parties and be like, why does no one else do this? This is the coolest, most nonchalant thing I've done. And I'm having a great time. Why is something so simple, so much fun?
Yeah, that's amazing. And it's something that's missing in most people's lives. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's like, just this past weekend, as we're recording this, was my dad's 70th birthday. My brother and I rented a house up on Lake Lanier, which is about an hour from where I live here in Georgia. We went up there for a weekend. We brought in all our food. My brother and his wife handled dinner one night, and then it was kind of by accident, but I ended up kind of taking care of the rest of the food. You know, my parents always laugh because they're like, when it comes to you, we always know we're going to eat really well. We don't have to think about it. And, you know, for me, the best way to share myself as well, this is kind of the creative part of me coming out, you know, love people, feed them tasty food. You're able to nourish people in a very literal kind of way. You're not just, right. you know, nourishing their Friday night. You're not just nourishing a friendship. I mean, food is medicine. Food is, you know, feeding the soul and the emotions, and
right.
you're creating camaraderie and a place for people to sit and, you know, look each other in the eye, which never happens anymore.
Yeah, that's amazing, JK. So we're coming down to the end of our time, and I have just two more questions for you. The first one is, who inspires you and why?
Ooh, that's a deep question. I would say, you know, especially with the last few years of everyone getting pounded, talking to other entrepreneurs can be really inspiring and encouraging. I think people don't realize the lengths that people go to just to get you basic things in life. And when it comes to making the world turn, you don't realize just how reliant we are, not just on businesses, but on the people behind the businesses, not just the folks that own them, but the people that work in them too. And so, you know, small businesses, I think, are the lifeblood, not just of our country, but the world at large. And even the big, you know, big, huge companies still are being sourced and supplied by smaller businesses and families. And so I draw a lot of inspiration from that. And it's really incredible. I know I've got a few online perfumery courses, and it's been really incredible to have played a little role in watching some of my students make themselves livelihoods, and in some cases, some very big companies. Yeah, that's a big source of inspiration for me. And really, again, it comes down to just people doing what they love and trying to meet needs and also meeting their own needs. I mean, all of us need money, and we need to pay for things.
The final thing is, I always like to just leave you with the final words. any words of inspiration or something that you just want to share with my listeners, this time is for you.
It's real simple. Be curious. I think in being curious, the whole world becomes a playground. And in the work that I do with aromatics, you know, so many materials come from so many places. When I work with a lot of folks, people ask me if I've ever been there, and to their country, and I'll say no, but my stomach has. And they usually get a kick out of that. And if my stomach hasn't, then usually my nose has.
Oh, I love that. I love that, JK. Oh my gosh, JK, it has been such a pleasure to reconnect with you on Aromatic Chat and hear a little bit more about your journey. Last year, really, at the Aroma Summit, you just shared about perfumery. It wasn't about you and how you ended up doing this. And I just really want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And just encourage people to check out Rising Phoenix. And if you're struggling at all with your health, like you said earlier, getting rid of some of that chemical load could really help. And if you like perfume, JK may be your guy. So there thank you. Thank you so much, JK. I appreciate you tremendously.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been wonderful seeing you again. And I really do appreciate being invited into the homes of people everywhere that listen to this. It really is a joy making products and knowing that I play a little part in cleaning up your lives, but also it's really hard to smell good stuff and not smile. So it really is a joy being able to make people smile. That is medicine in and of itself.
Oh, thank you so much, JK.
Hey friends, I wanted to read to you a review on Apple Podcasts. This is from Jennifer. She said, I heard about this podcast through the Aromatic Wisdom podcast, and as a certified aromatherapist, it has given me some fresh inspiration. The interviews are all interesting and from so many different perspectives in this industry. I also love that Melissa interviews people in different parts of their aromatherapy journey. I haven't really seen that anywhere else. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for your beautiful 5-star review on Apple. It is so appreciated. Every single review that is left allows Aromatic Chat to climb up in the ratings and for other people to find the podcast. If you would be so inclined, I would be honored to have you leave a review for Aromatic Chat on Apple Podcast or Podchaser or even at buymeacoffee.com/aromaticchat. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode with JK DeLapp. I thoroughly enjoyed getting to hear his story about how he started in the kitchen and took that inspiration all the way up to making natural perfumes. I loved his final words about being curious. And as a life coach, that is one of the things that I encourage my clients to do every single day, is to be curious. No judgment, just curiosity. Curiosity creates within us the opportunity for inspiration and the opportunity for transformation. I was so excited when JK said that about being curious at the end of the episode. If you're a brand new listener to Aromatic Chat, I really want to extend a very warm welcome to you. I am so glad that you're here. If you're one of my longtime listeners, really, I just need you to know how thankful I am for you. Thankful that you keep coming back episode after episode after episode to hear from these amazing aromatherapists. I hope you enjoyed this Aromatic Chat with JK DeLapp of Rising Phoenix Perfumery. Head over to Etsy and see all of the things that he has available for you. I love that he is helping people reduce the toxic load in their body. I want to let you know that over at buymeacoffee.com/aromaticchat, you have an opportunity to hear some behind the scenes, some meditations that I've recorded for you, and occasionally you'll get a very interesting update from me. You can become a member over at buymeacoffee.com/aromaticchat. That's buymeacoffee.com/aromaticchat. If you don't want to become a member, you can just simply support the show by buying me a coffee. Be sure to check out the show notes for any links mentioned in today's episode. Aromatic Chat is produced by Lemon Balm Coaching, and you can connect with me, your master transformational life coach and registered aromatherapist, on the web at lemonbalmcoaching.com. I will see you next time with our next episode. Until then, peace, love, and aromatics. Hey, friends. I want to introduce you to Blend Precisely, the software business toolkit for aromatherapists, herbalists, and formulators. When I first started out as a practitioner, I used spreadsheets, Word documents, my calculator, all of my safety books, and that was before I ever opened up a single bottle of essential oil to create a blend. Seriously, it took at least 20 to 30 minutes for every single blend that I made for my clients or my family. Whether you're a seasoned practitioner or you're just starting out, Blend Precisely will take the guessing out of the safety issues and let you focus on creating beautiful blends with ease. No more using multiple different programs to get your blends ready to go safely and effectively. Everything is calculated for you inside Blend Precisely. Dilution, percentages, chakras, perfumery notes, pricing, milliliters, ounces, grams, and more. Blend Precisely incorporates Tisserand's safety information so you never have a question again. There's no more guessing. One toolkit for everything. The best part about Blend Precisely is that it's not just a program that you sign up to use and then have no support. There is constant support from the creators, Katrin and Seth Burkholz. They have videos every week on their Facebook page, YouTube channel, and they even have a Facebook group for members of their community. I want you to know that Blend Precisely has a 14-day free trial. I suggest that you sign up for the trial, pull out some of your favorite blends and input them into the program and see what happens. Maybe even create a few new ones. Maybe even create some stock blends and see how Blend Precisely can support you in your aromatic life and business. I'm sharing with you my affiliate link to try out Blend Precisely risk-free for 14 days. Just click on the link to check out the software business toolkit for aromatherapists, herbalists, and formulators. And then use this toolkit to blend precisely.